This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
The nice thing about this pavlova is really, it's like people, when they imagine meringue, often they think it's something very sturdy, it's firm, but actually this one behaves just like a sponge, you roll it. And the way we achieve that is by baking it at quite a high temperature. So I don't know if many of you have made meringues before, but normally...
Yotam Ottolenghi's cooking isn't easily grasped. It's not from a single authentic source. He's an Israeli with Italian roots, and he's a connoisseur of various Middle Eastern cooking traditions. Ottolenghi made his name with a series of restaurants in London, and now, for an American, that may not all compute, but with half a dozen books, probably no one has done more than Yotam Ottolenghi to encourage an appreciation of Middle Eastern food that's way beyond falafel. The most recent book is Sweet, co-written with the baker Helen Goh.
Anything you like, really, because the beauty of it is that it is just an open canvas for people to play with. So I've got peaches and plums, I've got a little bit of vanilla in my cream and some icing sugar, and then I'm going to throw on some blackberries.
Before Yotam Ottolenghi was carved into the Mount Rushmore of celebrity chefs, he was on a different path altogether, philosophy. He was in a graduate program at Tel Aviv University that was so selective, students called it the Genius Program. He spoke with Jane Kramer at the 2017 New Yorker Festival, and Ottolenghi told her that as soon as he was done with grad school, he went off to train in the fine art of pastry.
When Yotam was finished with his dissertation in aesthetic and analytic philosophy, he took off for the Cordon Bleu and became a pastry chef. He said, "I don't ever want to read another book, and I don't want to actually ever live in rooms full of books after being an academic, but I'll tell you something. This is his sixth book, Sweet, and we're about to have his seventh book very soon, and he is totally a sweet tooth kind of guy. I knew he had a sweet tooth when I was in London writing about him, and I got really hungry one night coming back in the car, and Yotam said, "I've got some candy in my glove compartment," I opened the glove compartment, and the most appalling penny candy came out of it. And we both sat there eating it. And then we had a clandestine cigarette, and then we all went home, and it was thrilling. And so I want to talk about Yotam's, or I want him to talk about his journey from academia to pastry.
Yeah, like Jane said, I started in academia, and then I gave it all up when I was in my 20s. And when I finally did my master's dissertation, I sent a copy to my dad, and inside was a little note that I'm going to take a break and cook for the next year or so, and he was not impressed. And I have to say that my first work in a kitchen was actually in the pastry department, because often when you get a new chef coming into the kitchen, the head chef hands them over to the pastry chef because they just don't want to deal with them because they don't know anything. And then the pastry chef said to me, "Okay, well, you whip up my egg whites for the soufflés." So that's what I did for a few months. I just whipped up egg whites. I became this incredible expert in egg whites, which really came in handy over the years. And what I love about pastry recipes or cake recipes or baking recipes is they're very precise, and there's something very reassuring about this precision. If you're following a good recipe, then you're in good hands. Even with the food, I think you choose when you want to depart off and take your own way. And I always say, you know, you want to take your own way, make sure you do it when you've got to a kind of a safe place, With cakes, it's really easy. You can't just cut the eggs by half.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
they're not going to rise and you're going to get a pita bread instead of a sponge.
Yeah.
But you can play with the rest.
Yeah. But the safe place is there in all cooking, I think. But I know that when you and Helen worked on this book, that you have real arguments, and you think that that has always in some way harked back to your academic background, where the tradition is dialogue, often very contestatory. But this is what I've watched with the partners in Yotam's enterprise, is that they have real arguments, and wonderful.
Yeah. And these robust discussions are how we create, and it's always these partnerships, these collaborations, that makes it really, really exciting. And with Helen, it's been... So the way we work is that she... Helen is a real perfectionist. She's kind of very classically trained in the art of pastry, and she knows probably better than I do how things would react or interact in the baking process. And the discussions, like you say, they're very long, but they're quite geeky and intricate. And some people watch us and they go, and they kind of assume that we can't really be serious. There is a sense that it's either we're being kind of comical about it or funny about it, or this is just all an act, because we can really discuss whether it's 3/4 or 2/3 of a teaspoon of a spice that need to go into this cake, and really get into kind of a heated argument.
Yeah.
And in the end, we reach a compromise. But those arguments make great
productive
cakes.
And they make great cakes. Friends, and they make great partners.
Yeah, they do.
But they make great cakes. I notice in your cheesecakes, you have some mascarpone. You have the ubiquitous cream cheese of all cheesecakes. You have some ricotta,
we have a whole section about cheesecakes in the book, because we love cheesecakes, but also because, these were arguments. We couldn't decide which one to leave out, so we just included all of them. And we made a whole chapter about cheesecake. And actually, this feels like the right place for it, because New York is famous for its cheesecakes. But we have all sorts of cheesecakes. We have an Italian cheesecake, which is really very different. It has ricotta and hazelnuts and chocolate. And it almost feels almost like a shortcake. It's got a lot of body, although it's got cheese. And that's because ricotta has a higher water content than our other cream cheeses.
How different are cream cheeses from each other?
Cream cheeses...
That's a problem here.
Yeah, it is. The U.S. cream cheeses, the bog standard one is better. We have a higher water content in our cream cheese in England, so that we had to change the recipes a little bit from... when we translated the book from English English to American English, and cream cheese was one of those ingredients we had to play around with.
What are some of the dicier ingredients to translate from one country to another?
So it's really very complicated, because the basic ingredients seem very innocuous. You know, what is flour? Flour is flour. But actually, American flour is different from British flour. So this is the first book we tested. We had all the recipes tested in America for this book. Normally, it's like a translation, but here inverted sugars are different. So we use you guys use corn syrup, and we use glucose syrup. They're very different from each other. Yeah. That needed to be tested. There's a lot of things that are
also measurements.
The measurements are very different, and also I'm very evangelical.
And also here they're all different.
They're inaccurate, because you don't know how much volume is not a good measurement of an ingredient. Yeah. You want weight is much more reliable.
It's very difficult for us when our dog gains weight, and then we discover that the cup measure we've been using is about a third the size.
I never thought about that consideration until now.
Yeah, well, actually, it's my primary consideration usually, because he's heavier to drag around.
Is he overweight?
No, he's not overweight, but some people say Hobbs has gotten a little porky this summer, eating in these, so I don't know. I want you to talk about bringing the Mediterranean, bringing all of this, all these flavors, all these spices, all these incredible experiences to your food.
Yeah, I think I kind of, over the years, I went on a journey that included... So it started off from this corner of the Mediterranean where I grew up in Jerusalem, which was already pretty complex in terms of the flavors that were playing out, you know, because there were obviously the indigenous Palestinian cooking, and then all the food that has come with various Jews from various parts of the world have come. And I always say about Israeli food that it is really still in the making. You know, it hasn't fossilized, it hasn't taken complete shape yet. And for me, that, you know, those flavors that I was exposed to and grew up on, both at home and in the streets, were really pushed me to go on a certain journey. And that journey took me, like you suggested, first kind of west into North Africa. Lots of Jews in Israel come from North Africa, from Libya, Algeria, Tunisia, and Morocco. And so I've had those kind of exposed to them early on. But then when I travel to those places, I've seen all sorts of interesting things going on.
But the flavors of good Israeli food now have a huge Sephardic influence.
Yes, it has really shifted.
And they're in your food too.
It has really shifted. I mean, I think Jewish food, I have this theory that they all arrived, and then it was like a Darwinian thing. It was survival of the fittest. You know, the best example of everything is the one is survived. So from the Ashkenazi food, it's the babkas and the cakes. The gefilte fish kind of was just kind of pushed to one side. And a friend of mine says, you know, if you go to someone's house in Israel and you get gefilte fish, you know their grandmother is still alive.
I that's, but now tell me a little bit more about your next book, because your next book is called Simple, right?
Yeah.
And your next restaurant, when Yotam first decided he wanted to write a book, he was actually in that post-academic phase of, I don't want to see another book, another word, but he and Noam, I think it was, presented to a literary agent who said he should write a book. But before you do, you need a newspaper column. And there was a slot open at The Guardian, and it was the vegetarian slot. And this diehard vegetarian who had had the job for 50 or 60 years was retiring, and she was a kind of sacred cow, if that's all. God, that's the wrong thing to call a vegetarian. But she was, she was rigorous in her purity. But so Yotam said, but you know, I'm a carnivore. And they said, never mind, just do vegetable recipes. And the first, if I remember, recipe you wrote came with a little note under it saying, this would be really good with a grilled shoulder of lamb cooked in the garden. And the letters came pouring in from the vegetarians.
Yeah, and it was called the new vegetarian. So the new vegetarian was a meat eater.
That's right.
And, and that was raised, there were a lot of angry people, and completely justifiable to be justifiably angry. And I think the trouble was that I got the job before I really internalized what it means like to be a vegetarian. And I learned the hard way. I got a lot of angry letters. It took them a long time to accept me as someone who writes good vegetarian recipes, eats meat or fish once in a while.
So tell me, you're writing this new cookbook and you're now coming full circle with a vegetable restaurant, right?
Yeah. Next year, we're going to open another restaurant in London. And my idea, I don't know if it's going to work or not, we'll see what the customers say, but to have the vegetables as the main courses and the meat as the side dishes. Yeah. The idea is to kind of turn things around and make it a slightly different hierarchy in the restaurant.
I want you to talk a little bit about Simple, because it's it's another departure.
Yeah. So one of the things that my sister told me once, I'd love to cook one of your recipes, but I don't have the time. Really the way we've approached it is in the sense that I'm trying to understand people are looking for a way to cook ottolenghi that's not for a dinner party on a Friday night where you or a weekend where you can spend a lot of time. So the last year or so, we're trying to break what simple means for different people. And it's been the most amazing experience, only in the sense that I've really surprised myself that things tasted really good when the ingredients list had 10 ingredients and not 25, and it still had like all the kind of Ottolenghi characteristics.
And flavor.
And instead of 6 herbs, there were only 2, and those are really short recipes. And I look at them and I say, how can it taste so good if it's so short? But it actually can.
Okay. Listen, you're hoarse probably now, but we have loved talking to you.
Thank
Everybody
you.
Here has loved talking Thank to you.
Jane Kramer, a staff writer since 1964, with Yotam Ottolenghi. His most recent book is called Sweet, and later this year, there's a book coming out called Ottolenghi Simple.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.